I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Matt Inman. He lives in Austin, Texas, and is a licensed professional counselor and supervisor, and he is also the host of the Inefficiency Podcast. Matt, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I was interested to see what your background was in your early childhood, if you had a formative background in the spiritual practice or religious practice that drew you into what you do now.
Yeah. My dad grew up Catholic and my mom was Baptist. And so when they married, they met in the middle. And so I grew up Methodist and like kind of a formal Methodist, United Methodist Church. And that's where I grew up. And they eventually... We went into more like Bible churches and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Yeah. But I think my dad was a Vietnam vet and had a lot of moral injury and PTSD and struggled with alcoholism. And so I think alongside kind of for me, a lot of the spiritual journey was really seeing him. And where he went, like he went somewhere and I didn't know where he went emotionally and in his past. And I'm just an intuitive type. And it's like I'm so curious about that. And so I think him going in maybe kind of a dark way really allowed me to start looking at just going inward, period. Mm. Right. So, I didn't know what that looked like as a kid, but I think that really served me as I started to grow up.
Was it like a straight route into, yes, I'm going to do counseling? Or how did that journey take place then for you?
Yeah, so I went into the University of Missouri, which has the best journalism school in the world, really. And advertising was within that school. And so I was going to rid the world of bad commercials. Yeah. And like there was a creative piece that I loved within that. And, but I had been dating, a girl who's actually now my wife, in high school, and she lost her mom when she was 14. And I had dated her for 2 years and our senior year of high school, just depression and anxiety and all these things started to manifest because she had suppressed all of her grief. And I was kind of walking with her in it. And I had a kind of a lightning bolt experience with God my freshman year of college. And so I was really ignorant. Like I was like, oh, like I want to like serve people. I guess I need to go to Bible school or something, you know, like it was so ignorant of like, I don't know what to do with this weight now that I hold. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people were saying like, you should try counseling. Like you're the dude in the corner at the party talking with that one person. or like for my wife, like you listen and there's a presence about you. And so I went into, counseling my freshman year of college, pretty blindly, not knowing what that would entail, but knowing that something fit, something was congruent.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so then take me to, how did you get to Texas? Like it's a circuitous route that you took, right?
Yeah. Why the hell am I here? Yeah. I never thought I was going to be in Texas. When I graduated from the University of Missouri, with a counseling psychology degree, I knew I needed a master's, and I had no idea how to integrate any kind of spirituality with my helping skills. And I mean, my integration, like, kind of ceilinged out at like King David had depression. Like, and, you know what I mean? It was just like, it was so basic. So I knew I needed something, like somebody to help guide me in that process. And so I thought maybe a seminary would be better than another just kind of normal program or whatever. And once again, I was kind of ignorant. I didn't really know seminaries that much. And I picked out a couple, and one in San Diego, one in Denver, and then one in Dallas. And San Diego scared me too much. It was too expensive. And Denver, nobody showed up for my visit.
Oh.
And then Dallas worked out well. And it was a 3-year program. It was 95 hours, and that was kind of intimidating. But I chose to go to Dallas Seminary because I felt like they could integrate something for me that was very separate and disconnected for me. So that's how I got to Dallas. So I did that program in 3 years, and went to LA for a while.
Wow.
And went back to Dallas, and now I'm here in Austin. So I've kind of been everywhere.
Yeah. So what brought you to the West Coast then? Just a job situation?
My family's Filipino, so like pretty much every Filipino lives in California. Oh. Or Las Vegas or something. So we wanted to be out there for family, and I have an affinity for the Pacific Ocean. I could just stare at it all day. But we got connected with a church planner, and he was wanting to plant a church in Hollywood. And so that's what, like, legitimately brought us out to help start a church.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so now you actually supervise counselors. You moved out of the counseling, or do you still do some counseling?
I do counseling, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm primarily a therapist, but I do as well supervise folks that are moving in to the counseling profession.
Yeah. And what tends to be the things that you see over and over again that maybe created an impetus in you to branch out and to do things that are outside of what you do in just regular day-to-day work?
One of the things that I saw was that it's a very inefficient thing to go to therapy. Right? Like, especially, I mean, so many people come to see me in the middle of their workday. They drop everything. They come in, they spend a lot of money. They talk about pain. There's no guarantee that it's going to be better. And then they go back to work. And I'm sure some of them are saying, like, what am I doing? What am I doing? Mm. But yeah, people come back and they call it meaningful. And what I kept encountering doing therapy was that I kept hearing people say, I don't think about these things unless I'm here.
Hmm.
Like, I leave here and I've got stuff to do. Like, I got to pick up the kids. I got to go to work. Like, there's so many things I have to do that demand my time and attention. And it's going to be next week in here before I think about these meaningful things again.
Hmm.
And so... I guess one of the things that I encountered here that has led me to other things is just really understanding, like, how important it is to talk about what matters most to us, and that our daily lives don't often give space for what we really, really want.
Mm.
And so if I'm creating one inefficient hour for someone, for someone of my patients, like, how can I create a second inefficient hour, which is in part what led to the podcast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about when we're talking about what people really, really want, you would think that that would be the thing you would not be efficient about, but that you'd kind of focus your life on. But it seems like that the thing you really, really want is left almost a chance or left in the periphery or something like that. Then people have this inefficient hour that might be the most meaningful part of their week. And it's this tiny little slice of their life. And something about that seems very absurd or out of balance to me. And, you know, you're right. You're seeing this like, maybe we should have more of these moments. Maybe we should have more of this time when we're doing it. But what do you see that people really want?
Well, I call it deathbed desires. And, you know, you look at relationships, like when things get like really whittled down, like you're on your deathbed, it's typically relationships. It's your convictions and it's your spirituality. Mm. And they're very simple things. And did I live someone else's life or did I live mine? Was it okay to have been me? Right? Self-acceptance. And did I pour what I believe is the goodness in me out to the people that matter the most? Or did my job get it? Or did like my clean kitchen get it, or whatever it is. And I see people having at least an intuition that they have something that's in a beautiful way burdensome, you know, with deep convictions and deep love, and they don't always have words for it. They don't always know how to express it. And you don't have control over that, right? And in the day-to-day life, we don't get rewarded for that stuff. Like we get rewarded for showing up to work on time, to getting in the proposals on time, to staying late, to getting over our grief fast. Mm. Like those are the things that get highlighted. And it gives us a felt sense of control. Like we get to check off boxes, like we're doing something, you know? And so... These meaningful things kind of, like you say, go to the periphery and it becomes this little slice of our life that, like, I hope we can get to.
Mm, yeah. Wow. And it reminds me of, like, one of those things you said are relationships. So really planning to be with people and be totally 100% there while you're there. And, you know, with your family or your friends or your community. And actually showing up and being even ready to be there. I've been with people, and even I do this myself. I'm guilty of it too, or my kids. Mm-hmm. You're so used to having it screen mitigating that time and kind of as a distraction or something, and that it's actually almost becomes fearful to actually be completely 100% present because it feels so mm-hmm. abnormal and unfamiliar.
Yeah.
You know, like what have we come to? But the idea of how inconvenient it is, because I've had days where I make my own schedule. Most of the time I have a part-time job that I have to get in certain hours at a very, very specific times. But it'll be like, what did you do today? Well, I took a walk with a friend, you know. Maybe we walked for an hour and then we talked for 45 minutes. But it sounds like a total waste of time unless I actually got real exercise. Uh-huh. But it actually wasn't, because that was such a deep and fulfilling and meaningful time. But to anyone else, it'd be like, really? That's okay. You know, that doesn't sound like I did anything, right?
You're just sipping wine.
right.
Must be nice.
Yeah. Right. It must be nice. But really, if you think about all the time you spend on media, you could also just put those things down and just stare, you know, into someone's eyes or be near them and actually connect. It's just that we haven't prioritized those things. But you talk about relationships and relationships being essentially inefficient, right? I mean, they're to really connect is in many ways inefficient by other standards.
Yeah, I mean, I think of parenting, for instance. I mean, for me to connect with my son, he's turning 5 this month, and I have a newborn. Like, they don't care about my schedule. They don't care about the stuff I have to do. Like, they're gonna have a tantrum for no logical reason, right? If my daughter doesn't want to sleep, she's not going to sleep. She doesn't care what I have going the next morning. And if I don't watch it, I'm going to be an ass to them. You know, like I'm going to be so impatient because I've got stuff to do. We've got to go places. And I'm going to miss their pain. I'm going to miss their age appropriate crises. And I'm going to miss their uniqueness, their gifts. The things that they invite me into, like play, and me realizing I need it just as much as they need it. I need the pillow fights. I need the sword fights. Like, my life is way too serious, right? And so if I don't accept in that I'm going to be late to things and that I'm going to take way too much time trying to get my son to forgive or asking forgiveness from my son, like, then I think we start to do harm to them. And I mean, that's just like just one example, but I think there's a way that we kind of hope the day goes and we can push so much stuff in it to try to be efficient and maximize time that we end up not living out the of the true self or living out the way we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're kind of, the podcast is medicinal really for you in many ways. It's not like, let me teach you a few things. It's like, I'm learning to be inefficient because I know that it's good for the soul.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been trying to think of it more, not just as a concept, but as a decision filter. And this summer I had pursued, it's actually in Pennsylvania. I pursued an analytic certification. I was going to become a certified analyst. It's a 3-year program with unbelievable people. I don't know if you're familiar with Labrie, kind of Francis Schaeffer's kind of thing. They kind of take that model, and amazing people. And I really wanted it. I pursued it. I got accepted. And then I said no. Right. And I said no because my daughter was about to be born. My son, I felt like, really was going to need my attention in that transition. And that my wife was going to be cool with me doing it, but I think would have been holding a lot more. And I didn't want her to feel even tempted with that kind of resentment. And so part of me, the efficiency is like, I could have done it. I could have done that, but I decided not to, and to make my life a little more inefficient in that way. And so, yeah, like it's even me exploring, what does this actually look like, right? Like, not just it sounds good, but it is good.
So who are some of the people that you've had on your podcast and maybe some nuggets that you've picked up along the way so far?
Oh my goodness.
You'll just have to pick a few because I'm sure there's plenty.
Let's just go through all 43. You know, I had Dan Allender on, psychologist Dan Allender, and he did a 2-part series on sex trauma. And not even just the abuse side, but also like emotional incest and things like that. I think one thing that sticks out in that is just this idea that when we try to push something down that we don't want to experience, it's almost like we throw a rock into a pond and we think, okay, that's good. Like, that's gone. It's out of sight. And I think there's a little bit of, so I can move on, right? Like, and so other people can see me move on. And we think that that rock sitting at the bottom of the pond, which is ourselves, is just hanging out. It's not doing anything. When in reality, there's an active toxicity to it. And it is changing the dynamic of the water. And we can't, like one of your former guests, like Peter Rollins, like we can't just keep repressing and repressing and repressing. And I really just like that idea, or right, like the picture of understanding how many times do we just throw stuff into that pond to try to get on. And so much of my work is going like scuba diving, right? It's like going down and collecting rocks with people. And so that was one. But there's so many. Like it's hard to, I think I probably get something out of each one that like something that sticks with me and something I think about. And it's continually, I guess on the flip side of the toxicity piece, there's these other rocks that just continue to bless me. And I let them simmer, you know, and kind of all mold together into some kind of beautiful stew.
The rock stew. Yeah. But it's the hard part is too, you get a lot of information in, but if you're really on like a tight schedule or something like that, you might not get a chance to sort of absorb it and practice it. But it does sound like you're getting to practice a lot of your inefficiency stuff in regular real life.
Yeah. And I think what helps is, you know, I was trying to write a couple years ago and I never felt academic enough for journals, and I never felt, you know, I like Relevant magazine and some of those things, but it feels like everything has to have a number in it right now, you know, like five things and all that. And I don't write like that.
Yeah.
And so I never was getting picked up for anything. And so part of the podcast too was like, I'm going to write an intro and outro. And whatever they say, I'm going to try to expound upon as a therapist. Yeah. And so for me, like it's just a discipline of going back and not just doing an interview, but listening and like what's resonating with me and what does that look like through my filter and writing in that way. And then what's the cool, amazing thing is that I'll have clients come back into session and then what resonated with them.
Oh, wow.
Right. And then so now we're using some therapy time to go deeper in their life based on something that I shipped out.
That's pretty neat. And
yeah.
And even going over and mulling things over and writing that is kind of a spiritual discipline or practice of its own.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I noticed that your podcast sometimes has an audience involved, and you also got to go to Hawaii too, right?
Yeah.
How cool is that? Back. Yeah, right? What is the deal with that?
Well, for the Kauai experience, I know a guy up in Dallas who has a retreat, and they take people to Hawaii, like especially Kauai, and they do body work, kind of rolfing and some yoga, and they bring me in to do reflection time and this one, they're like, just talk about inefficiency, like, and how are we inefficient, and the beauty of that, and how, you know, they say the island does about 80% of the work for you, you know,
yeah, right.
and you spend just a couple of days in Kauai and your rhythm's different and you're kind of in a raw, true state, and you're ready to accept things in, like you're not defending all these things. And so it was kind of it was a really cool experience to talk about inefficiency. And I did a podcast out there kind of with people who are more body centric and just really looking at how everything's connected and how even in the body world, people come in saying, hey, just, you know, my knee hurts, just fix my knee. Like real quick. And it's just like, well, you know, like your knee hurts because like your back's out of whack, which is makes your pelvis tilt, and then your like leg goes in. And so like to really address the knee, we have to address like the back, right? And it's like, I just fix my knee, you know, like there's a mentality, especially if we've been hurting for so long. It's just like, we just want relief. And how even, whether it's in a spiritual world or like, it's all related, it's all one. Right. And so like when we even say spiritual or physical, like we're creating these like man-made delineations. Right. And we can almost believe that they're by themselves and independent. So that was kind of a cool, just to be able to collaborate with body folks, you know?
Because we, even when you're working with someone, you're working with their mind, but of course there's a body mind connection that we can't pretend to separate. If they're, you know, I was talking with someone recently about, placebo and, how fascinating it is about how placebo works and what type of placebo works in different countries. And it's not that it's fake. People are more genetically predisposed, and there's certain markers that people will have the ability to heal themselves by suggestion. But it's really healing. It's not fake healing. You know, it's actually really healing. so there's this.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. There's this real, you know, evolutionary necessity to be able to do that in the wild. You know, to be able to convince people that they're being healed, and then for them to actually be healed. But that's obviously happening because the mind is doing something, creating the circumstances by which someone can be healed. But we're tending to think that, oh, the mind is this one thing and it's doing all the thinking, and then the body somehow gets ill, and you know, the two don't really meet up, and you know, all these weird constructs that somehow don't touch.
Yeah.
But especially when it comes to pain, Parkinson's disease, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorders, placebo is extremely highly effective. And it's now there's a lot of ethical things where they can't do certain things with testing placebo, but there's all kinds of and like what color placebos to give people and things like that. It's remarkable. But you would think you know, a lot of drug companies would stand to lose a lot of money but people could especially in terms of pain management, be able to essentially initiate their minds to start killing some of those pain, turning some of the pain off on their own.
Wow.
Incredible stuff. And
it is.
And I know, I'm sure that people, once they are in therapeutic counseling with you, as they're working through things, they can start feeling better when the repression stops, or when some of the emotions that they haven't dealt with might have turned into disease by then. Like, we don't tend to think of that as what's happening, but a lot of times stress will eventually come out in some kind of manifested disease. I don't know if that's pseudoscience or not, but it appears that, especially in terms of pain, that's can be the case.
No, totally. I mean, I don't have like some report to back it up or something right now, but like I know several patients that are like they can't express. Like they've always, there's some clog at their throat, right? And then like they just, like their whole life, they have all this stuff and they just don't know how to get it out. And then they have like a, you know, thyroid cancer, or, you know, different issues with their neck and their throats and their mouth. And, you know, we store stress maybe in our shoulders or in our back. And like, just even over time, like we slump or we don't engage the core, and just how much that even connects with what we think of ourselves and how we view ourselves and what we want to lead with, you know, and things like that. And so, yeah, I think it works both ways. Like, I think people start to do some of the emotional work, and then they start to feel improvement in so many other ways too. Right.
Yeah. Actually, I'm reminded that in the show notes for this episode, I will include a link to the Tim Ferriss episode where there's a one guy who's talking a lot about placebo. And I realized that's how my friend and I got to talking about it, because I was mentioning, you know, there was this guy and he was talking about, one of the things was that people in France like suppositories and they work especially well, and we're not totally sure why.
Oh no.
But those placebos work really well. And then people,
that's funny.
Yeah, we're not gonna say why. I don't know what's up with that. But and then
well, people are probably like, this better work.
Yeah, right. If I have to do this, it's gonna work. And people in England like foul smelling like potion type things. And if the worse it smells, the better they think it works. And it's, well, and the better it does work, because if you're assuming that it works, a certain percentage of the population doesn't seem to respond, but a lot of people do. And it's really fascinating. It's not that they're fake well. You know, it really is really fascinating. And so I will include that in the show notes, and I'll send you a link to it, because I think it's incredibly fascinating when it comes to like reframing our problems or reframing our reality or seeing ourselves instead of as a victim, as a person who thrives. And as we're dealing with our problems or our wounds or in therapy, that as those things change and we have a breakthrough, you know, people become less tired or have more, you know, they have not just more energy, but less pain, and they can focus on other things instead of all the stuff that's been this barrier. It kind of makes sense that everything, you know, like all boats rise. Like once you make a breakthrough, you can experience a lot of other positive benefits. And so, yeah, it was kind of, it's interesting what you say about people having throat problems or mouth problems when they haven't been able to get things out. It's really fascinating, because I think we've been, it's just been this Western thing about seeing everything in different spheres that don't touch, I suppose.
Yeah. So. And siloing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, right.
You see that in like churches and everywhere. It's like, oh, I'm the junior high guy. Like, I don't know anything about senior high. Yeah, it's like, whatever it is, it's just like, man, we don't.
I'm a specialist, so I wouldn't know anything about that. Yeah, I do music. I don't know anything about prayer or whatever.
Yeah, and it's understanding how much. Like, you're touching one thing, you're touching everything.
Yeah. You
know? And we can't be experts on everything, but but wow, like what we miss, you know, when we silo.
Mm-hmm. Or just even think we don't dare touch something else because it's too presumptuous to get into something else. Like, sometimes we'll just do that out of like, well, you know, that's not my thing. I've noticed this in people are doing it in a good way, in a modest way, but like, the more people get educated, they don't want to speak to something else, which can be fine and you know, intellectually humble, which is good. You don't that's appropriate. But I've noticed, you know, you want somebody to, do you think you could speak to this? And they'll go, well, I really can't, because, you know, I can't speak to this portion of the New Testament because I only study Old Testament. It's like, yeah, but I bet you were also taught Greek.
Yeah.
Where you went to school. And I have a feeling you probably know, you know, you probably spent maybe like 9,000 more hours than I did studying it. So I bet you probably could speak to it. But it's funny how, I mean, there's still a caveat you could put in there. This is not my total specialty. I'll speak to it. There are better experts out there. But it's almost like this presumption that, well, there's somebody else who's better qualified, so I just won't even touch it. And thinking that everything should be siloed, and I just will stick in my little niche and I won't touch any other thing. But, you know, I think maybe then you can miss out and other people could probably miss out too.
Totally.
So I was curious too, of what kind of religious or spiritual community are you involved with now? And does that at all work into how you podcast and how people take part?
Yeah. I go to a small little church in the east side of Austin called Vox Vignier. And it's been like it's been food. honestly, for my family. I don't know if we would be going to church without a community like this. I just so much of the old, I say old way, just doesn't really speak to me. Like they're in kind of the normal evangelical way. It did for a long time, and I'm thankful for it. But it's a group of artists and therapists and spiritual directors and people who are quoting Rohr and Merton and leaning into mystery and vulnerability and empathy, and even like seeing Jesus as the incarnation is the ultimate act of empathy, you know. And so once again, it speaks more of my language, but it hits me and convicts me, and I it's been very impactful. Just even being surrounded by so many people creating, I think before I started the podcast, I knew I wanted to create an impact and ship something out, but I didn't feel like I was your typical creative, you know, like I don't paint or I don't know what I would do, you know, and whatever I'm going to create is probably going to look like a third grader did it, you know? And so understanding like, oh, I think I could do this. I could do a podcast. I could write, I could talk and explore and do some of the things I do in therapy. And I think being around that community, who promotes that and honors that and supports that has been huge for me, you know, to not feel like I'm moving against some current. But in reality, I'm being pushed, you know, and to risk. And so I've had some folks on from that community, on the podcast, and, has helped me a lot. Yeah.
Mm. That's great. They nurture all that in you and help it flourish, help support it.
Yeah. And we talk about the Enneagram a ton, you know, and I'm a 9. And so I need that support, right? I need some support to step out and be bold and say, here I am, take it or leave it. Like that's a really hard movement for a 9 as a peacemaker. And so just to continually be talking about that, like next couple weeks, I'm speaking on disappointment there. And then the week after that, we're going on a retreat, and it's an Enneagram retreat. Right? So like, it's just a cool space that I haven't seen before. And I think that more and more faith communities are going to move that way, right? To understand what are we projecting onto spiritual communities. I had a guest on, Erin Lane, who she had a really beautiful comment. She said that with spiritual communities, with education, with politics, we often use the word disillusioned. And she says, we talk about it in this negative connotation, but really, if you look at the definition, it just means to be freed from your illusions. And I think that's a good thing. And so when we look at like a church, for instance, a spiritual community of any kind, the question is, are they creating disillusionment or are they delusional? And I've found a place that consistently creates disillusionment, that they will not save me. They will not, I'm not there to consume. And I'm going to figure a lot of things out about me that I project onto them that will actually heal me. And so I'm constantly getting freed from some illusions that are actually saving me.
Well, that's really, you hit on something there. So what you're talking about is a little, that kind of is a dark turn sometimes, because a lot of people go to church to feel better, but you won't necessarily feel better if your illusions are getting stripped away.
Yeah, and then I mean that does, and once again, I'm sure this probably enters into some Peter Rollins, but there's a sense of how much do we want our spiritual leaders to believe for us, right? Like we know they struggle, but we like don't tell us about your struggles. Like don't actually like name. Like you can name like that you're prideful,
Or that you
right?
were like 3 years ago had
Or yeah,
a
you had struggles, but like we actually don't want you.
yeah.
Like we'll fire you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and like, it becomes actually a very heavy thing. Is that we no, actually, seriously, don't say it. And I think there's a lot of things like that that I need. Like, we do need places to come and celebrate or to feel hope and inspired. But if that's the only thing we want it for, it becomes something like weird, right? And what does that say? I think to me, like you look at people who are willing to like we're willing to go into debt m most for the things of escapism, right? So like when you start to look at distractions, like how much of the need for feeling hope and all those things is good and relieving and grace, and how much of those are just a continuation of Candy Crush?
Right. I had on a guest, Kester Bruin. I don't know if you are familiar with him at
Yeah,
all. Do you know who I mean?
he's
And he talks
totally.
about, he talks about like some people use drugs and then some people use Jesus. And for the exact same thing, and if that's what's going on, that's a problem. And,
Yeah.
humans want to get high. It somehow, we want to get high. Escapism, like escape to another planet like Mars, or
Yeah.
maybe go have ayahuasca and have a little experience like that, or maybe have an ecstatic experience in worship where you feel lifted up. But the thing is, if and that's nothing really wrong with that in some form, occasionally, perhaps sometimes to feel lifted up, but Jesus isn't a drug. Like, this is a way of the a student of Jesus is a way of life. We're talking about a way to be in the world and not go away from the world. This is a way to actually get through the entire, like you're saying, the incarnation is a form of empathy. That's not a form of incarnation isn't a form of escapism. It's the exact
Yeah.
opposite.
That's yeah, no, I love everything you're saying, 'cause it's like it's we want to go high. We want real self-realization and we want all of these things, and yet like we do see Jesus coming down. We see a kingdom coming down. Like we can go to the top of the mountain, but we're supposed to come down and allow something like there's a ground, like we have to go down to go up, right? And I think that feels inefficient. It's just like no, like I'm sure like we could find a way to just go up.
Right.
Like surely there's a way we could bypass all this stuff that is confusing and time intensive and energy zapping, and let's just like find a way to get high. I even if we can do it, I think like it ends up harming us.
Well, yeah, it's only really serving yourself in the end. Like, does it really connect you with anybody else? Because that's the thing I was wondering about. I was really mulling this over because I'm a Richard Rohr person and a mystic, really, and that's really hard to, when I say mystic, I always kind of like roll my eyes at myself because I don't even know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I in terms of I do not want to objectify God and say God is somewhere, right? So, there isn't like God isn't located on a throne in heaven. That's that's very silly, you know. we're talking about something very silly that we can't do that. We just can't do that. And so I want to realize God in a very full way that makes sense for life and makes life better for me, but for common life, right? And I was noticing something in worship that was very, just seemed idolatrous in itself, maybe how I was doing it or maybe how others were doing it, but it was very objectifying of God. And I thought, well, sometimes we're getting this worship thing all wrong. It's like we're just picking the next object and trying that. You know, we're just picking the next thing and objectifying that, but we're calling it something holy, but it's still another golden calf. And that if we're realizing what that God is, you know, if we're seeing where God is ground of being, or realizing that God can be worshipped, of course, but that we're also not forgetting, at the same time, we're also holding intention that God is in you, in my brother, in my sister, God is in the least of these, you know, if we're also holding that in the same posture. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky. I mean, the brain can only hold so much. But, yeah. At the same time, as soon as you start locating God, even in worship, you're starting to go right off the rails. But I was like, you know, I got to just get Richard Rohr on here, but, you know, he's a busy guy. And I would be like, because he talks a lot about the understanding God as Trinity helps with that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you're not going, there you are, God. There you are in Jesus and that's it. No, you can't do that either. And, you know, you can't just go around pointing God out, because then you're going to kind of forget what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the whole thing, is God wants to escape your grasp. It's the wild goose. And so too often we're deciding that we've decided we know where God is. And at that moment that happens, the whole, you know, house of cards goes, because there's no such thing as figuring that out.
Yeah, which is so, I mean, I was reading a poem, I can't remember who it was by, but even just the idea of like saying God or saying like my wife's name, Aaron, like how frustrating it is that it just doesn't encapsulate what we're actually getting at, right? And like it's frustrating and beautiful all at the same time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, these are the things that plague us and get us into these conversations that we never really stop having. But at the same time, the things that we experience as humans that we're trying to figure out, how do we, like you're saying, the inefficient things and the things that have the most meaning in our lives, these are the conversations we keep talking about, no matter if our ideas about God shift or not. And even if we give up the idea of God completely, because I've talked to plenty of atheists on my podcast, they keep having the same conversations too. They're just redirected a little bit. And the conversations don't change. They're still the same ones. You know, there's still the questions about meaning and the questions about being connected to other people and being appreciated and what is my life for, or something like that, getting some kind of recognition. So it's fascinating. And I'm sure that as you talk to people in your practice, eventually everybody, it boils down to, do I matter? Does anybody care about me? You know, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't enter into these conversations in this efficient way of like, here's two things I want to get out of this, and I need to change my mind or not change my mind after this. Like we both you and I, in this unspoken way, know that like we'll probably connect, and we won't know or like necessarily have this like well, things might shift, but like there's not going to be this like massive product at the end of it. But like there's something meaningful in this that moves us, that keeps us going, that feeds us. And that's the thing that, like, my guess is even in my deathbed desire, your deathbed desire will matter. Is like, did I feed in this life? Did I take in what was around me? And was I curious? And did I, did I accept some of this stuff in and marvel at it, or did I just mindlessly consume? Mm. And my guess is like that matters to you, and that matters to me, and that's what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, those connections and the ones that you're having with people. Now, do you have things lined up, and do you want to give anybody a taste of what's coming on your podcast? Or
yeah, it's all like, maybe for you it's a little different. Mine's probably a little more inefficient in a bad way, but I just had a conversation with Jamie Drakowski from To Write Love on Our Arms. That's yes, going to be coming yes. out. I'm really excited about that. And what else? It looks like I'm going to have Brian McLaren on soon and talk about his book. And yeah, anytime I can get some psychoanalysts on, like, are really good. And so there's an author, Marie Hoffman, who I'm going to have on at some point. She just wrote a book about kind of some of the evangelical, like the guys in like the early 20th century that really got a lot of this movement going, that actually they had a lot of trauma in their life. Mm. And looking at how some of this stuff might be coming out of trauma.
Yeah.
Right. And some of the rigidity and stuff like that. So I'm excited to talk to her about some of those things. I'm trying to have another live, Inefficiency Live. Hmm. I don't know what it's going to be about yet, but I would love for people to look out for that, because those are always fun to do more live events. So
yeah. So yeah. Where can people find you? Is it just inefficiency.com, right?
Inefficiencypodcast.com.
Right. Inefficiencypodcast.com.
They can look at that. I'm on Twitter at inefficiencypod. I am on Twitter sometimes overwhelms me. So I'll get on it for a while and then I step back. But, and then Instagram at inefficiencypodcast. I feel like I'm kind of moving a little bit more toward that.
Yeah.
But yeah, inefficiencypodcast.com and is a good place to go.
Yeah, I'll cut this out later, but if you use Buffer or something like that, then you can just line up your tweets and you don't have to bother with Twitter, because it drives me crazy too. It's like, especially like now when everything's like, oh, WikiLeaks, oh, Clinton, oh, Trump.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You're like, whoa, stop.
Yeah. It's overwhelming.
Yeah. So I just line up mine up in Buffer, what I'm going to do.
That's
like
good.
Maybe like 70% of them or something. And I do try to interact with people, but for just the stuff that to do with the episodes and things. Although I have a lot more episodes, so I feel like I have to do that, or I just be kind of glued to my stuff. And I'm trying to do a lot more self-care with doing fasts of media and things like that. Mm-hmm. There was, I don't know if you read Nautilus online, Nautilus magazine. It's just nautil.us. But okay. There's fantastic articles in there now about the phone, and you know, it's a science magazine, but some things about B.F. Skinner and how people have purposely designed the phone to become addictive, and which we kind of already know, but it was really, really good. My daughter's 13. I'm like, this is required reading. We'll be discussing it later. So that's even more of a conviction to me to keep
cool.
it in its proper place. And
yeah.
You know, maybe it's inefficient to not get back to people immediately. It's just going to have to be like that.
Yeah.
But there's some really fascinating articles about where they might have to, in the future, like smoking, put some certain regulations on things, like where you can't smoke in planes, or used to be you could smoke in planes and hospitals. And, and they might eventually have to make it where there are certain regulations on how often you can be notified, because it's so damaging. To be interrupted and to be It's so like can cause so much anxiety and for certain people, so obsessive compulsive stuff. So
interesting.
Yeah. It can push certain people right over the edge.
Yeah.
But, you know, nervous habits. So now it's the new smoking, but it's way, way more addictive than that because of all the dopamine, all the dopamine rush is going on. This has been such a nice chat with you and thank you for sharing your time with me. Maybe we can join up again. It would be fun once in a while to join up and like pick one or two episodes that really like moved you and then like kind of do recaps.
Yeah, I'd love to. And it's an honor to be on Spark My Muse. Yeah, so thank you.
No problem. This was really fun. Forget to check out sparkmymuse.com with their show notes to this episode and every episode with related links and photos and all kinds of extra goodies. But I also want to ask a special favor too. Please donate $5 or $10 to the show. It's listener supported. It makes a very big difference when you help out. Another thing that helps out is a rating or review on iTunes and spreading the word with friends and family. Please help the show survive, and thank you so much for listening.